Turbo! Let's get ready, let's get ready, let's get ready, Rumble. Right, that's recording. And that's recording. And now I need to clap. And now you need to clap. No! Loudly. Really?
That's as loud as it goes, really.
There you go, that's a clap.
Sorry, I moved closer to the mic. Yes.
That's as loud as my hands are stinging, Martin. Okay. From the basement, the only blockchain podcast that interviews the forgotten and downtrodden devs that actually do the work, hosted by me, Martin G. And this episode, we'll be talking to Skymaster Ryan Gledhill about what makes a good quarter developer. Hi, Ryan.
Mr. Martin, how goes it?
Well, I'm looking forward to this one, I tell you that. Ryan was Ryan is a bit of a superstar in the quarter world. He is currently CTO of Ivno, a digital asset settlement provider. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's about right. I can probably elucidate that slightly more if you'd like me to. But yeah, Ivno's a settlement provider built on DLT. Built on Quarter specifically, that enables 24/7 immediately reconcilable, secure settlement capabilities. And as you had Adam on previously, and he mentioned, it's been built in such a way that it's designed from the ground up to enable effortless integration with existing and incumbent systems.
There you go. You heard it here first.
You can tell I've done that one before.
Yeah, I can tell, yeah, just a few times. Ryan's been doing this for about 2 years. Prior to that, he was the lead front-end developer at Funfair. Prior to Funfair, he was at a company called F3 Systems, which I think for about 3 or 4 years, he helped grow with the founder into a very successful entity. I think you've given me some numbers before, but that was a success. And prior to that, he was running, I think for about, again, about 3 or 4 years, a firm called Chimply Web Group, which was actually his own company. And just when he shut it down, he sold off one of the products for a six-figure sum. I think that we should go into the questions now and come out with a few more juicy details. What do you think, Ryan?
Please.
Right. What company do you work for, Ryan?
I work for Ivno.
I've got to rewrite these questions. what do you actually do for Ivno?
So at Ivno, I'm the CTO. So I run many of the technical. I run the technical side of Ivno. So clearly, that's if that's leaning on people that are better than me at coding and removing blockers. That's one large part of my job. But also it's talking to clients and shareholders and partners and the ecosystem as a whole, and just making sure that Ivno is seen as a leading technical entity in the ecosystem.
Fantastic. And how old were you when you started programming?
I think I was about 20.
And do you... That was a bit late. I thought you were going to say like 5 or something.
No, 20. Oh. Yeah, a bit. I was a care nurse and a chef before that.
Amazing. There we go.
Yeah.
Amazing. A care nurse? What?
Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
For dementia patients. I'll tell you what, you learn... there's a lot of life lessons to be learned there. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I bet there are, yeah. Have you got a nickname?
Well, you tell me, Martin. I have a nickname?
Skymaster. where did you grow up?
So I grew up I was moving a fair bit, actually. So I grew up initially in Hampshire, Portsmouth. Mm. And then I moved to Barking. After Barking, I moved to Grays and then Canby Island. I wouldn't say they are the most spectacular spots in the UK. But they gave me an interesting upbringing, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I know. I come from Essex, and I know those places myself. And they are, for anyone who doesn't come from the UK or know the south of England, but yeah, Grays and Canvey Island, they are fairly rough places, yeah. Lovely places. Where did you go to uni and what did you study?
So I didn't, and this was through choice. So because I think very early on, I've been of the opinion that experience trumps academia. And to delve a bit more into that, I think if your life path involves scholarship or research, then clearly academia is the best route to go down. But I think actually that's a very narrow subsection of society. And I think in all likelihood, most of us follow the path of academia in order to progress in a career at speed. So I actually believe that for the majority of us, academia and career progression are orthogonal. So I mean, for example, let's take a list of qualities that ensures employers can extract maximum value from you as a developer. We're looking at business analysis, for example, leadership, creativity, working with legacy code, writing software to requirements, project planning, scoping, architecture, vision, all qualities that are sought after within senior technologists that develop purely from experience and often can't be taught in a classroom. And it strikes me that why should we spend our formative years when our brain is most pliable and learning is easiest on hard skills, when soft skills are not only what will set you apart from the crowd, but they'll give you that baseline to continue learning those hard skills as we progress. And also, you know, learning is a compound skill, right? So having a wide range of both soft and hard skills as early as possible enables you to learn exponentially.
Amazing. I think that was definitely the best answer I've had to this that question so far.
Yeah, I feel very passionate about that whole uni conversation.
I can tell. Rightly so. When did you start working in software?
So I would have been, so I started as an apprentice. So it would have been about when I first started coding. Day one, I hadn't touched a line of code before that. So around 20, 21.
Which industry have you spent most of your career in?
Good question. I mean, so to go back to my previous rant on university and education, I think my career history is intentionally varied. So as I was saying, generalist knowledge is, in my humble opinion anyway, the best approach. Spending too long in any vertical of technology can potentially ensure narrow viewpoints. So I don't think that's a specific, for me, I don't think that's a specific industry as such, but it does feel like I'm starting to, or I'm certainly specializing in blockchain and DLT. And that's probably where I spent most of my time in tech at the moment. And it's my passion.
Okay. What's your operating system of choice?
Well, so currently I use Mac OS. I'll be honest, I think Mac OS has been oversold. I think it integrates very nicely if you've got an iPhone. I'm not sure it offers you too much beyond that, apart from less money in your wallet. So I've always been a big Windows fanboy. And whilst we were at F3 Systems, we all used Linux, which was great, except we had to reinstall our hardware drivers every week, which was not perfectly ideal. But I think it's come a long way since then. So yeah, probably Windows, but often it's not the best developer experience, hence why most people use Mac.
Okay. What's your programming language of choice?
Good question. So I've spent most of my career using JavaScript, and I'm a big fan of Kotlin, and I think most people have said Kotlin so far. So I'm not going to say Kotlin. I'm going to say I'm going to say TypeScript. So I think a strictly typed version of JavaScript, given that JavaScript has such a varied ecosystem, it hit all the right buttons for me at the right time in my career. And I've spent a lot of time writing with TypeScript.
Okay. When was the last time you wrote some code, and what did it do?
It's a very good question. So my job at Ivno is to remove barriers, to allow those who are better at coding than me to efficiently write said code. So I actually often don't get the opportunity to slap the keyboard anymore, so to speak. That said, I recently wrote an Ethereum smart contract, and the idea was to enable, the idea was to enable a bet that my brother made with one of his closest friends. So his friend has bet that Bitcoin will reach $10,000 before it reaches $20,000 from its current point, whilst my brother bet the opposite, which is interesting. Now, what makes it yet more interesting is that the stake is two relatively embarrassing photographs that are held in escrow until one day. And then the loser's photograph.
Sorry.
The loser's photograph is then indelibly written to the Ethereum mainnet. For the rest of the
no way.
Yeah. So now I might be wrong, but I think this is exactly the use case that Vitalik had in mind when he wrote the Ethereum mainnet. But yeah, so that's the last bit of code I wrote.
That's just fantastic. Okay. Well, I'd be surprised if your brother wins that bet, but let's find out. Right. What's your favourite music to listen to whilst you code?
It's a good question. So I'm actually a big fan of hip-hop and grime, just as being a millennial. Yes, I know, yeah. But let me take you back to the areas I grew up in. and then you might understand. But no, also, you know, if I'm heads down coding something, it's generally something a bit more electronical, something with a predictive beat that you can type to. You don't have to use part of your brain to listen to.
Cool. Name one skill all programmers should have.
One skill all programmers should have. Business analysis. Where, as programmers, we're creators. People come to us with ideas, or we have our own ideas, and we create code, we create software that hasn't been built before to enable people to do things that often hasn't been done before. Now, if you design code without the requisite business analysis, then you'll design code as to how you expect it to work and not how your users expect it to work. And that's a very easy way to make sure that this great code that you've just written is completely useless. So spend some time in the first phase researching, talking to customers, talking to your target market, and you won't regret it.
Love it. Is Agile a force for good or for bad?
We have, we have a very talented individual who was on this podcast a few weeks back, Adam Dry. Mm. Now, Adam Dry is a Scrum Master, but the beauty of what he's able to do is that he takes business analysis and requirements and program and project management and combines them all into a level of pragmatism. And I think the original idea for Agile was not to define very strict rules that everyone must follow. It's to define some rules as guidelines, and you then adjust those rules as to what suits your team best, as to what suits your project best. And that should if you're using Agile correctly, differ from project to project and from where you are in the software lifecycle. So I think with the right person at the helm, it's a force for good. I think otherwise, most people use it poorly.
How long have you been using Calder for?
Since November 2018. Two years. In fact, 2 years, almost to the day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why did you get into Calder?
So I was headhunted by Ivno and Dan Halstead, one of the co-founders specifically. Now, this has kind of come full circle. In every project, I think you should start by gathering requirements. And many of the requirements of Ivno, so privacy, transaction speed, ease of development, an active ecosystem. All of these at the time were only offered by Calder. Now I think that's changing, and I think Ethereum and specifically Enterprise Ethereum is moving in that direction and is going in the right direction. Whether it's there or not yet, I think it is. I think it's much harder to start on Ethereum than Calder. But at the time, it ticked all the right boxes. And I think it still does.
Awesome. What's the best thing about Calder?
Best thing about Calder? I'll be honest, I think the best thing about Calder is the ecosystem. So I think within a month, I've spoken to a number of Calder heavyweights. I spoke to Fuzz month one. I spoke to you month one. I think I even spoke to Mike Hearn on month one, and we started breaking down requirements. So R3 as a company, they do very well in furthering that ecosystem and pushing that ecosystem forward. But I think also the ecosystem itself, i.e. the developers and the architects and the builders, they all, because it's a nascent industry, they will help each other. So that's the beauty of it. I think if you join an existing larger ecosystem, it can sometimes be harder to become ingrained and to have your questions answered and to contribute. So the ecosystem.
What's the worst thing about Calder?
I'm going to preclude this by saying that R3 do a brilliant job in innovation, in driving forward the ecosystem, as I say, in partnering and in working on use cases and demonstrating. I think they do an exceptional job. I think what they could do slightly better is those error messages, because they can be painful. I'm lucky in that I have to write less code nowadays, but I often hear that as feedback. So I think that could do with some extra work as a constructive point.
Okay, cool. And finally, and I think we're going to cover this indirectly in a minute, but what is the best place to start with Calder?
Yeah, great question. So currently, I think there are a varied list of resources. I think the best place to start currently is the R3 website. Get yourself on a boot camp, start reading through the docs, and really start hammering away at the keyboard. Find a hang around in Calder Slack channel. Find a number of use cases that you find interesting and that the ecosystem as a whole needs to solve, and start trying to fix one of them. Even if you don't get very far, you'll find you get feedback from the industry. You'll find you speak to people, and you'll find you learn quicker than you think you're learning. However, I do think there are a number of resources that can be hard to find when you first enter the ecosystem. So I have an upcoming blog post called a Cordopendium.
Ooh.
I know, which is where I'm planning to amalgamate all of the resources that helped me and that I think might help others.
Yeah.
So I'll be putting that together as within the next month or so.
I think it needs a wiki. That's what I think.
I agree.
I
agree.
It needs a wiki. Yeah, and then you can add to it. Chainstack can add to it. You know, maybe some guys at R3 can add to it. But I think if it was a wiki that was kept up to date, and it was the wiki that everyone, it was the one place where everyone agreed should be the golden source. Then I think that would be really, really useful. Yeah, good
I
call,
agree.
Yeah. So we want to talk about what makes a good Corda developer. Okay. Now, actually, I think the title of this podcast should more properly be called "What Makes a Good CordApp Developer." but seeing that everyone just calls it a Corda developer, let's just run with that. What do you think? Do you think we should start with your own developer career journey prior to Corda,
sure.
and talk about how that helped you get to do the things that you've done and get to where you have done through Corda?
Sure. So you've actually given me something to talk about when with what you just mentioned around Corda versus CordApp developers. And I think there's a distinction there that should be made clear. And I think one is more useful than the other. Now, let me explain. Now, a CordApp developer is somebody who puts together flows, contracts, et cetera, and writes a CordApp that can be deployed to CordaNet or to a private Corda ecosystem or whatever it needs to be. A Corda developer is somebody who can write CordApps, but can also write integration layers. Can also write other software layers that aren't necessarily built using Corda. So, for example, at Ivno, we write TypeScript libraries that interact with our Corda, but they don't need to be CordApps. And not only does this give a template and a skeleton for, let's say, a bank's development team to come on board, see what we've done, and write their own interactions with their CordApp, which allows us to keep the base CordApp very, very tight and non-bloated. It allows them to come in and add to the existing CordApp, to the baseline CordApp. So I think there's a difference between CordApp and Corda developer. I think your question was where did I start talking about my journey a little bit?
Yeah.
I actually started as an apprentice and I was working directly with clients, building websites and software solutions for 2 years. I then went on to found an agency, as you mentioned, doing much the same thing as during the apprenticeship, but throwing myself in the deep end directly with clients. I created an online entertainment directory for parties, weddings and the like. Sold that for a six-figure sum after 2 years.
Nice.
And then a young Adam Dreyer asked me to join him to create a project management system from scratch, which is, in all honesty, one of the most useful periods of my career. Everything was created bespoke and from scratch. And the level of complexity we managed with a small team was unbelievable. I think there's now around 200 million worth of active projects on there. Around that time, I fell in love with blockchain and DLT. I spent most waking hours learning about it, much to the annoyance of my fiance at the time. I then joined a startup called Bunfair. And this was around the time the crypto industry was in full bull market mode. So it was definitely an interesting time. And Funfair raised close to $40 million in ICO. So we had a ton of resources. We had some real talented staff. And my favorite part was that the team was recognized as being the first to architect and deploy stake channels as a scaling solution on Ethereum.
Yeah.
So to give some context on what that means, we completely eradicated the issue of having a minimum 15-second block time between turns. Instead, it became effectively a real-time application, which was the first time that had been done on Ethereum. The transactions per second of the application went from around 13 to 15, which is the current logical limit of Ethereum mainnet, to somewhere in the region of tens of thousands. So that was a really cool time. That's the definition of being at the cutting edge. So that was really exciting. I was then headhunted to join IBNO, where Dan Halstead, Chris Rainer-Cook, and myself were the first to architect and shape the original version of IBNO. Clearly, since then, we've grown the team. We've been through a number of fundraising rounds. We've iterated the product. And we have some industry-leading partnerships and client engagement. So our next challenge is to quickly scale the customer base, really disrupt the market, and prove the power of not only IBNO, but Corda. And that brings me to this interview today.
And so looking back over that experience, what are the things that you feel happened in your career that helped you to be a good Corda app developer?
So I think one of the main value propositions that has given me an edge due to the experience I've had, that I've been lucky enough to have, is to understand other protocols. And I think, again, this comes back to being a good Corda developer versus a Corda app developer. You should understand other protocols such as Hyperledger, Enterprise Ethereum, and the like. I mean, there are hundreds of protocols out there nowadays. But we will very quickly enter a period of interconnectivity between chains. So it's our duty as Corda developers and Corda architects and builders to understand wider protocols and their benefits and limitations, as that level of interoperability is just around the corner. And RGB, it talks about this all the time. He's seen it coming. But you will absolutely be asked by clients and other employees why Corda is better for some sort of scenarios than others, and of course, vice versa. And you must be comfortable and have done some development work on other protocols to really master DLT and to really master the Corda ecosystem.
That's really interesting. Do you think it helps at the beginning when you're first learning Corda? Because one thing I've experienced is that basically most people start with Corda knowing just a little bit, at least a little bit, about Bitcoin and Ethereum, right? And what that means is, you know, we come to Corda with, you know, a set of language tools that are born from effectively, you know, a reasonably different system. So for instance, you know, there are no flows in Bitcoin, and there's not a consensus algorithm, you know, it's not all about the consensus algorithm. Corda is not all about the consensus algorithm. So it feels that at the beginning, you know, you have to, when someone's, you know, that's one thing that we've noticed at Corda Code Club, is that, you know, when someone's first trying to learn and get what Corda's all about, we almost have to de-Bitcoin them, or de-Ethereum them, and then start again.
I think there's an argument for both points there. So I think, like any wider technology stack, so let's take database protocols, for example, there are certain instances where a standard MySQL database is the best option. There are other instances where no SQL databases are the best option. And there are yet more instances where people try and shoehorn a NoSQL database because it sounds cool into a situation where a MySQL database would be better. And I think that's true of all technology stacks. But that said, there are solutions such as DeFi, which perhaps lend themselves to Ethereum as an ecosystem more so than Corda. I think traditional finance lends itself to Corda for obvious reasons, peer-to-peer privacy being one of them. So I think having that wider range of knowledge can be useful to choosing the right tools and to choosing to choosing the right way to build your Corda app. But you're right. I mean, so if you're used to Ethereum, which operates on a gossip protocol, and you come to Corda, which is a peer-to-peer protocol, a lot of people are confused by that. And they say, well, actually, well, Corda isn't a blockchain. And they're right, Corda isn't a blockchain. Corda is a distributed ledger technology. So to understand those nuances, in my eyes, can only be useful.
Do you think then that Corda is to Ethereum what SQL is to NoSQL? Do you think there is similar and as different?
I think Bitcoin was a kind of a layer zero cryptocurrency, layer zero blockchain. And we wouldn't be here talking if Satoshi hadn't created Bitcoin. I think then Vitalik iterated on that with a layer one, which was Ethereum. And I think they're iterating on that further with enterprise Ethereum, with scaling and sharding and various other techniques that they're using to bring Ethereum mainnet and sit into the mainstream. I think Corda's one step beyond that, in that it's useful and applicable to existing business cycles. So yes, I do. I think MySQL came first, and NoSQL came afterwards. I think you just need to be very careful to choose the tool that fits your business analysis, and not just the newest one.
So on that then, given your experience with Ethereum at Funfair, any experience you have with blockchain prior to Funfair, and Corda at Ivno, how do you think Corda compares to the other DLTs and the other blockchains out there?
So I think, as I say, I think Corda is more applicable to most business workflows currently. Not all of them, but most of them. I think it builds on some of the very useful parts of public blockchains, such as being able to share resources, immutability, and the like. I think in terms of privacy, Corda and the early Corda architects have made a brilliant choice in ensuring that by definition, by architecture, there's a privacy layer. So it's peer-to-peer. So for example, with the enterprise Ethereum leans on heavily on zero knowledge proofs, which are great. And there's some great people doing some zero knowledge proof work in the Corda ecosystem as well, ING to name one. However, if you lean on zero knowledge proof only, it's a single point of failure. It's zero knowledge proof is still very new. We're still finding bugs in it. We're still finding problems. And until something's been around for 10 years, you can't really consider it tested. So having that architectural layer, even if there's a zero knowledge proof layer over the top, will actually, you still have that guarantee that only those who were in the transaction or who should be in the transaction will have their data leaked. So it's an architectural guarantee as opposed to a technical guarantee. So that's one of them. I think also, I love Ethereum. It was my first love, so to speak, in blockchain. I don't want to insult it in any way. But the decision to create the Ethereum virtual machine or the EVM, and the decision to create a brand new language in Solidity, and there's a few other languages that they use as well, I think is a mistake. As we've seen, there's been a number of hacks, the DAO hack, etc., and these were all due to re-entrancy bugs or similar similar Ethereum virtual machine issues, or similar Solidity issues where people just didn't understand what they were writing because there weren't there wasn't enough examples out there. Now, Corda leans on heavily well-known technologies, so message queue protocols that are well-known, MySQL, very well-known, the Java virtual machine that's been around for, what, 25 years. Everything's been battle-tested. And there's a well-known saying in blockchain, which is don't roll your own crypto. And I think the same is true of don't roll your own tech stack.
It's interesting, isn't it, the way blockchain is more and more being used by the blue chip bulge bracket, financial firms, and yet it's because it was born out of this cyberpunks and that kind of this kind of weird kooky libertarian, whatever you want to call it, basis, 10 years ago, it's still got these few echoes of that, and obviously roll your own.
Yeah.
It's got to be one of those.
It is bizarre, actually. I think this happens with most technology cycles. So I think, is it Gartner that does the hype cycle?
Yep.
Where you get this brand new technology. You get a bunch of geeks who think it's brilliant, and then you get the those that lean slightly towards the Luddite end that say, no, that would never catch on. And they said that about PCs, mobile phones, and the like. So I think when you get that sort of interest, and people were regularly and still do cast down Bitcoin with weak media interpretations. But I think that's actually a sign of the next step of the hype cycle, which is when institutions get involved and there's a lot of talk about funds buying Bitcoin. There's a lot of talk about the Ethereum Enterprise Alliance. Corda has a number of groups and ecosystems that are building insurance products and all sorts. So I think we're at that next stage where we see the all of that hype being realised.
Amazing. Brilliant. Cool. I think that's a fantastic place to finish it on. So what makes a good Corda app developer, in a nutshell? What was it experience with other blockchains and context?
Yes, experience with other blockchains. Business context. Business analysis and requirements gathering, and whatever you do with any technology, make sure you get those requirements and then iterate. Don't start with a perfectly coded product that nobody wants.
Yeah. Brilliant. Ryan, thank you so much. Hope you have a great day.
Martin, always a pleasure. Let's catch up soon.
You've been listening to another episode of From the Basement. You can find all the previous podcast episodes on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. This poignant piece of prattle was planned, prepared, processed, percolated, pasteurized, and produced by Martin G and put into pixelated picture form by Oscar Pseudo-Phenomenal Bennett, because this was From the Basement.